Ever wondered why some banks seem to be, well, just printing money, expanding everywhere, while others are just barely getting by, kind of stuck? Or maybe you've traveled, you're using your bank app somewhere else and thought, wow, this is totally different here. Why isn't it like back home?
Mm.
Yeah, it's not just about interest rates or those shiny apps. There's this fascinating, really complex web of factors underneath it all.
Absolutely. It shapes the whole financial system, the arteries of the world economy in really different ways.
So today we're doing a deep dive into exactly that, global banking profitability and competition. We've been digging through a whole stack of analysis looking at, what, 26 key global markets?
That's right. Industry reports, macroeconomic data, even some, you know, surprising academic takes. It's a lot of material.
And our mission for you, the listener, is to pull out the most important stuff from all this. We want to get beyond the headlines, you know, beyond just the simple numbers on a balance sheet. We really want to understand the true drivers of success in banking. Think of it as like a shortcut to being properly informed about this critical and often pretty opaque part of the global economy.
Sort of a masterclass in understanding how money flows globally.
Exactly. And we're going to challenge some conventional wisdom along the way, reveal some surprising differences between regions. We'll explore the hidden impacts of things like regulation, technology, and ultimately give you a new way to think about what makes a banking market attractive, maybe stable.
It really is a global story, but one with hugely diverging paths. Much more nuanced than you might think.
Okay, let's get into it. Let's unpack this.
So the first thing that jumps out, looking at the data, is this fundamental divide across the globe. And when we talk performance, we really have to start with return on assets, ROA.
Right, ROA. That's the bedrock metric.
Pretty much. It tells us how efficiently a bank uses everything it owns its assets, so loans, investments, cash, to actually generate profit.
It's like an efficiency rating for the whole bank's operation.
Precisely. How much bang are they getting for their buck, asset-wise?
And when you look at those raw ROA numbers, the picture is, well, it's stark, isn't it? Maybe even a bit counterintuitive.
It really is. In 2021, the data showed that many of the highest ROAs weren't in the places you might first guess. They were often in emerging or frontier markets.
Like where?
Well, Ghana, for example, posted an amazing 4.9% ROA. Kazakhstan was up there at 4.37%. Brazil, a solid 1.86%. These are really strong numbers, signaling healthy profits, often tied to faster economic growth.
Okay, so emerging markets leading the pack there. What about the advanced economies?
That's where you see the contrast. Many advanced economies, particularly in Western Europe, Japan, they were anchoring the lower end. Germany, for instance, in 2021, had an ROA of just 0.12%. Barely positive.
Wow, 0.12%. That's
very
thin.
Very thin. And the global average that year was about 1.57%. But that number really hides the enormous spread. You had extremes like Syria, reportedly at 8.83%, down to Greece at minus 1.82%.
So that average number doesn't tell you much on its own. Huge variation.
Exactly. Massive divergence.
And this isn't just like a statistical blip, right? This huge gap. It points to something deeper.
Definitely. It reflects completely different economic rhythms, different levels of competition, maybe even different ideas about what banks are for.
So why such a gulf? Is it just growth potential, market maturity, or something else?
It's a mix of things, and it forces us to look beyond the surface. It's not just about the economic cycle.
It's not a perfect split either, is it? Developed versus emerging?
No, absolutely not. You have crucial exceptions. The U.S., a very developed market, kept a healthy ROA of 1.59% in 2021, actually doing better than many other developed countries.
Yeah, so the U.S. holding strong.
And then you have places like Singapore, a major financial hub at 1.01%. Sweden, known for efficiency, at 0.95%.
Right. So just labeling a market developed or emerging isn't enough.
Not at all. It immediately tells us you need to look market by market. Broad regional labels just don't cut it. They miss the real story.
Which means for you listening, you got to think beyond those simple categories when you're assessing a country's financial strength or maybe where opportunities lie. And you definitely can't just look at a high ROA number and think, great market.
Right.
Because those high returns, they can come with big risks.
Exactly. That's the critical next step. High returns often mean high risk. It raises that key question. Where are the risk-adjusted returns most attractive and, crucially, sustainable?
Sustainable, right. Not just a flash in the pan.
It's not just about how much profit you can make, but what risks you're taking to get it and how reliable those profits are likely to be.
So how do we measure that stability? How do we get beyond that raw profit number?
One powerful tool is the bank Z-score.
Z-score. Okay, what does that tell us?
It's a measure of stability, specifically the probability of a banking system defaulting. Think of it as gauging the distance from insolvency.
So like how much of a safety cushion they have.
Exactly. It combines profitability, ROA, and the capital cushion, equity to assets, and compares that to how much profits tend to swing up and down the volatility or standard deviation of ROA.
Okay, so profit plus cushion divided by the wobble factor.
That's a good way to put it. Higher Z-score means more stability, lower chance of going bust. It's not just about the average speed. It's about how likely you are to crash.
That makes total sense. It's about consistency and resilience, not just peak performance.
Precisely. And when you look at Z-scores globally, a really important pattern emerges.
Which is?
Many of those markets with the really high headline ROA, they often have higher volatility too. And that higher volatility can significantly pull down their Z-scores.
Ah, okay. So the high return is basically compensating for higher risk.
Often, yes. It might be macroeconomic risk, political risk, regulatory uncertainty. You're getting paid more because the ground is shakier.
Whereas the stable, developed markets.
They might have lower headline ROA, but their earnings are much more predictable, less volatile. So they end up with higher Z-scores, making them inherently safer long-term bets.
Wow, okay. That is a crucial distinction. That idea that high returns can actually be a warning sign, that really shifts the perspective. That's a real aha moment for understanding this stuff. A big profit number today might hide a big risk for tomorrow. So understanding risk-adjusted performance is key.
Absolutely critical for investing, for policy, for just understanding the landscape. And we can layer on more detail here. We can look at other indicators to get an even fuller picture of health and efficiency.
Like what else?
Non-performing loans, NPLs, that's a very direct measure of asset quality. Are the loans banks made actually getting paid back?
Right. A high ROA doesn't mean much if a ton of your loans are going bad.
Exactly. If you see high ROA paired with high or rising NPLs, which you do see sometimes in emerging economies under stress, that's a big red flag. It signals underlying weakness, potential future trouble. Much less healthy than moderate ROA with low, stable NPLs.
Okay, so NPLs check the quality of the assets. What about operational efficiency? How well are they actually running the business day to day?
That's where the cost to income ratio comes in. It's straightforward. How much does it cost the bank to earn a dollar or a euro of income? Lower is better.
Like overheads for a regular business.
Pretty much. If you're spending 45 cents to make a dollar, like in Singapore, 45.4%, or Sweden, 48.6%, that's incredibly efficient. You've got lots of room for profit.
But if you're spending, say, 88 cents on the dollar, like Germany was.
Then you're struggling.
Yeah.
88.6% in Germany's case, it leaves very little margin for error or profit, makes it tough regardless of how big the market is. Efficiency really matters.
So putting it all together, ROA gives you the headline profit. Z-score adjusts for risk and volatility. NPLs check asset health, and cost to income measures efficiency.
Exactly. You need all those pieces. The goal isn't just high ROA in isolation. It's sustainable, efficiently generated, risk-adjusted returns. That's the sweet spot.
Makes sense. And this isn't a static picture, right? These things change over time. We need to look at the trends.
Absolutely. The banking world is constantly shifting. Looking at how ROA has moved over the past decade or so reveals really distinct paths for different countries. It tells you about the underlying forces at work.
It's fascinating how different markets react, isn't it? Like different ecosystems. What about the U.S.? What has its trajectory looked like?
The U.S. has shown a pretty clear cyclical pattern. ROA peaked before the pandemic, then took a sharp dip in 2020, you know, the initial COVID shock, banks setting aside huge loan loss provisions.
Right, bracing for impact.
Then a very strong recovery in 2021 as the economy bounced back. But since then, through 2022 and 2023, there's been a steady decline in ROA.
Is that decline a worry?
Not necessarily a sign of crisis. It more reflects the system's sensitivity to the broader economy and, importantly, monetary policy. As interest rates went up and conditions tightened, profitability normalized after a period of, frankly, exceptional stimulus and liquidity.
Okay, so a cycle influenced heavily by policy. What about somewhere like China? A different story there.
A very different trajectory. China's banking ROA has actually been on a slow, steady downward trend since the mid-2010s. It was over 1.2% before 2015, but fell to 0.86% by 2021.
Why the long-term decline?
It reflects several things. A maturing economy, for one, narrowing interest margins as competition increased and regulators put some caps in place, and also increasing pressure, often on state-owned banks, to support the real economy, sometimes prioritizing national goals over maximizing bank profits.
Interesting. a structural shift. And then there's India that seems like a real turnaround, almost bucking the trend.
India is quite remarkable, especially the private banks. They face big problems with bad loans, pushing their ROA down to just 0.51% in 2020.
Pretty low point.
Very. But since then, they've staged this dramatic V-shaped recovery. ROA climbed back to 1.63% in 2023 and hit a record 1.87% in 2024 for those private players.
What drove that recovery?
Strong economic growth, definitely, but also successful efforts to clean up those bad loans, resolving the asset quality issues. It really highlights the dynamism in that market, at least for the private banks. They showed real resilience.
These different paths really hammer home that point.
Mm-hmm.
A market's current ROA isn't as telling as its trend and what's driving it. Where you are matters less than where you seem to be going.
Precisely. And that leads us straight into the macroeconomic context, because you can't separate bank profits from the health of the wider economy. GDP growth, inflation, interest rates, they set the stage.
And they're the weather system the banks operate in.
Exactly. Sometimes it's a tailwind, sometimes a headwind.
So is it as simple as stronger economy equals stronger banks?
Largely, yes. But with nuance, always, there's a strong link. Higher GDP growth usually means more demand for loans, businesses expanding, people buying homes. That leads to fewer loans going bad, lower credit losses, and ultimately better profitability for banks.
Makes sense. Like we see in India and China.
Right. Their strong growth projections, India around 6.5%, China around 5%, help explain their banks' generally higher ROA compared to slower growing places like Germany, which has been hovering near recession. More activity means more banking business.
Okay, and interest rates. That's been the huge story globally recently, central banks hiking everywhere. How does that feed in?
Oh, interest rates have a massive impact, mostly through what's called the net interest margin, or NIM.
NIM, the difference between what banks earn on loans and pay on deposits.
Exactly. And the rate hiking cycle that started around 2022 was a big boost for many banks. Why? Because banks can often raise the interest rates on their assets, their loans, faster than they raise the rates they pay on their liability, their deposit.
Ah, so the gap widens.
The gap widens, NIMs expand, and ROA gets a lift. We saw this clearly in Germany, actually. Despite its structural issues, the rise in net interest income pushed its ROA to a 25-year high in 2023. The UAE saw its ROA rise to 2.0% too. It's like a gift from the central bank, in a way.
That's fascinating. Even low-profit markets can catch a favorable macro wind. But does everyone benefit equally when rates rise?
Definitely not. And here's where local market specifics really matter. The impact depends heavily on how competitive the local deposit market is.
How so?
Take India again. Even as the central bank raised policy rates, there was intense competition for customer deposits between public and private banks. So banks had to raise their deposit rates quickly, too, to attract or keep funds.
Ah, so their funding costs went up fast, eating into that NIM expansion.
Precisely. It pressured their NIMs, limiting the upside from the higher policy rates. It shows that a bank's funding structure having a stable, low-cost base of deposits is absolutely critical to actually benefiting from rising rates. If you have to fight hard and pay up for deposits, you won't see the same boost.
So macro conditions are huge, but always filter through the local reality. Which brings us to the market structure itself. The conventional wisdom, the thing we always hear, is fewer big banks means less competition, which means bigger profits for them.
Right.
Concentration equals profit.
That's exactly the market concentration hypothesis, H1. It sounds logical, but when we actually test it with the data, well, it gets much more complicated.
How do you test that? What metrics do you use?
The main tool is the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, HHI. It measures market concentration by looking at the market share of all the firms. You square each firm's share and add them up.
Okay, and it ranges from near zero to 10,000.
Right. Low numbers mean lots of small players, very competitive. High numbers mean fewer, bigger players, potentially less competition. U.S. regulators often use 1,500 and 2,500 as thresholds for moderate and high concentration.
But if you don't have HHI data?
Then we use simpler concentration ratios like CR3 or CR5. Just the combined market share of the top three or top five banks gives you a quick snapshot.
So when you apply these measures, does that simple idea hold up? Does high concentration consistently lead to high ROA?
Surprisingly, no. Our analysis across different countries shows a really weak, often inconsistent link between concentration and ROA.
Really? So it's not a reliable rule?
Not at all. Sure, some highly concentrated markets like Canada and Australia are quite profitable and stable, but there are major outliers that just blow up the simple hypothesis.
Outliers like?
Like Germany. It's the perfect counterexample.
Yes, Germany again. So on paper, it looks concentrated.
Very. If you just look at the big private banks, their CR3 was nearly 80% in 2021. Looks like a classic oligopoly.
But the profits just aren't there. ROA was tiny, 0.12% then, maybe 0.46% in a record year recently. Not what you'd expect from a cozy oligopoly.
Absolutely not. It completely contradicts the simple concentration equals profit idea.
So what's the secret in Germany? Why doesn't concentration lead to big profits there?
It's down to Germany's unique three-pillar banking system. It's not just those big private banks. You also have hundreds of public savings banks, the Sparkassen.
The local, municipally owned ones.
Exactly. And they have a public service mandate. Their primary goal isn't maximizing profit, it's serving the local community, providing banking access.
Okay, pillar two. What's the third?
The cooperative banks, Volksbanken and Raiffeisenbanken. Again, huge networks, member-owned, focused on their local members and communities, not shareholder returns above all else.
So these other two massive pillars aren't playing the same profit game?
Not at all. They compete fiercely for local deposits and loans, often operating on thinner margins because profit isn't their only or even primary driver. And that intense competition from these public and cooperative players drags down margins across the entire system, even for the big private banks.
That's fascinating. So the headline concentration number is totally misleading. It's not just how many players, but who they are and what motivates them.
Precisely. The institutional fabric, the objectives of the players, that's far more critical than just counting heads or market share. Germany proves that.
A crucial lesson. Concentration alone tells you very little. Okay, what about somewhere like Sweden? Also highly concentrated, but a different outcome.
Yes, the Nordic model, particularly Sweden, is another interesting case. Sweden is extremely concentrated. CR3 is almost 90%. It really is an oligopoly of a few big pan-Nordic groups like Nordea, SEB, Handelsbanken.
But unlike Germany, it's not leading to super low profitability, is it? But maybe not super high either.
Exactly. It hasn't resulted in exorbitant profits. Instead, Sweden is known for incredible efficiency and technological advancement. Their cost-to-income ratio is excellent, around 48.6%. Their payment systems are almost entirely digital. Cash is rare.
So in that kind of oligopoly, how do they compete? If not just on price.
The competition seems to shift. It's less about undercutting on loan rates and more about who has the best technology, the slickest digital platform, the most efficient operations, the best customer service.
A race for quality and efficiency, not just price.
Right. They invest heavily in tech, in user experience. The result is a banking sector that's stable, moderately profitable ROA around 0.95% in 2021. But without those excessive profits, you might fear from an oligopoly. Consumers benefit from really good, convenient services. Norway shows a similar pattern, good ROE, amazing cost efficiency.
So even in a tight oligopoly, competition can still be fierce, just different, focused on tech and service. Okay, let's pivot to emerging markets again. State ownership is often a big factor there, right? Another layer of complexity.
A huge factor. In markets like China, India, Brazil, you have a major presence of state-owned banks, SOBs.
How big are we talking?
In China, the big state-owned commercial banks hold over 40% of all assets. They're dominant. In India, the public sector banks, PSBs, recently grabbed back a huge share of the home loan market, over 40%.
So they're not niche players, they're central. That must create a weird dynamic.
It creates a kind of dual-track environment. SOBs often have a dual mandate. Yes, be commercially viable, but also achieve government policy goals.
Like lending to certain sectors or boosting financial inclusion.
Exactly. Supporting specific industries, lending in rural areas, maybe keeping employment up, things that might not be the most profitable in the short term. Research generally shows SOBs in developing countries are less profitable than private banks, which pulls down the overall market ROA.
So lower average profits because of this policy role. But is there an upside? Maybe more stability?
That's the potential trade-off. During a crisis, SOBs can act as a stabilizing force. When private banks get scared and stop lending, the government can lean on SOBs to keep credit flowing, acting as a countercyclical buffer.
So maybe lower average returns, but potentially less volatility, more resilience to shocks.
That seems to be the pattern. It creates a unique risk-return profile for these markets. If you're a global bank looking to compete there, you have to understand you're not just dealing with market forces, but also with these policy objectives and different cost structures. It's political economy as much as finance.
Okay, so market structure, who the players are, their goals, all crucial. But then there's the referee,
yes,
regulator. How do the rules of the game shape things? How can we even measure the impact of regulation? It feels qualitative.
It can feel that way, but we do have tools. We can quantify aspects of the regulatory environment to understand its impact on stability and efficiency.
Like what?
A key one is the World Bank's Regulatory Quality Index. It's based on perception, surveys of businesses, experts about how well the government makes and implements sound policies, how predictable and effective the rules are.
And it's scored from money 2.5 to plus 2.5.
Right, with higher scores, meaning better perceived regulatory quality.
So who scores well on that? Where is regulation seen as effective and stable?
Typically, major financial centers and well-developed economies. Singapore scores very high, 2.31, Switzerland 1.73. The Nordic countries also rank near the top. These places are seen as having effective, predictable, fair regulatory systems.
And lower scores might indicate
higher regulatory risk. Maybe rules change unpredictably, enforcement is inconsistent, or there's just more red tape. That can be a drag, even in a high-growth market. Then there's a more quantitative measure, bank capital adequacy ratios, or CRR.
The capital rules, Basel Accords, and all that.
Exactly. CAR measures a bank's capital relative to its risky assets. Higher CAR means a bigger buffer against losses. It's a direct measure of how stringent the safety regulations are.
Okay, so with these measures, regulatory quality perception, capital stringency, we can test another idea, right? The regulatory efficiency hypothesis, H2. Does better regulation lead to more stable profits, lower ROA variance?
Yes, and the data generally supports this. We find a strong positive correlation between that regulatory quality index score and banking system stability, measured by the Z-score.
So good regulation equals stability.
It seems so. Markets known for high-quality regulation, Singapore, Hong Kong, Canada, Switzerland, are also models of stability. The regulations might prevent banks from taking excessive risks that lead to super high short-term profits, but they're very effective at preventing crashes and reducing volatility.
Like good brakes and airbags on a car. Maybe limits top speed slightly, but makes the journey much safer.
That's a great analogy. It means robust, clear, predictable rules actually create more attractive environments for long-term investment. It's not about weak rules, it's about smart, effective rules.
But there's that perennial debate. Does forcing banks to hold more capital, a higher CER, hurt their profitability? Is it a direct trade-off?
It's the classic question, but again, the data shows it's not a simple inverse relationship.
Oh, so high capital doesn't automatically mean low profit?
Not necessarily. Look at the UK, very high capital ratios, around 21% total capital. Sweden, also high, over 18% CET1, yet both have profitable banking sectors.
So how do they manage that?
It suggests that well-managed banks, operating in supportive economic environments with strong business models, can generate enough underlying profit to offset the cost of holding more capital. The drag isn't automatic or overwhelming if the core business is healthy.
So context matters hugely. It's not just the rule, but how banks operate within it.
Exactly. And while some theories suggested regulators might go easier on capital in concentrated markets, the reality post-2008 financial crisis has been a global push for stronger capital everywhere. CER is now more like a necessary baseline for safety, not the main thing determining profit differences between markets.
Okay, so the written rules and capital levels are important. What about the day-to-day supervision, the enforcers, the watchdogs? How much does their quality matter?
Hugely important. Beyond the rulebook, the quality, the proactiveness, the intelligence of the supervisors is paramount. Good supervision can actually enhance efficiency and even drive innovation.
Can you give an example?
Look at the UK's Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA. Their big investigation into retail banking led directly to the Open Banking Initiative.
Right, forcing banks to share data with consent to boost competition.
Exactly. That wasn't just about enforcing existing rules. It was actively reshaping the market to make it more competitive and innovative. That's a sharp tool approach, not just passive oversight. It fosters dynamism.
So proactive supervision can be a positive force.
Definitely. And reports from bodies like the BIS or IMF give qualitative insights into how effective national supervisors are, how they handle crises, how they're tackling new risks like cyber or fintech. These qualitative aspects help explain performance differences, even between markets that look similar on paper. Smart, adaptive supervision makes a market truly well-regulated, minimizing compliance costs and uncertainty.
Okay, we've covered structure, the players, the rules, the referees. Now let's talk about the big disruptor, the force accelerating everything, innovation. Fintech. You can't discuss banking today without it. How disruptive is it really turning out to be?
It's the central question, really. The Innovation Disruption Hypothesis, H4, suggests a major impact. But like everything else, the reality is nuanced.
How do we even map where fintech is having the biggest impact?
Venture capital investment is a pretty good proxy. Where's the money flowing? That tells you a lot about the maturity and dynamism of a country's fintech scene. It shows where the innovation pressure is likely highest.
Okay, so based on recent VC data, say 2023, where are the global hotspots?
The U.S. is still way out in front. $24.2 billion in fintech VC. Just dominant. The UK is a clear number two, but much smaller at $5.1 billion.
Still significant, though. Who else?
Then you have a strong second tier. India at $2.5 billion, Singapore at $2.2 billion, both emerging as major regional hubs, especially in payments, lending.
Any other notable players?
The UAE is rising fast, $1.3 billion. Hong Kong, nearly $1 billion. And even in developed Europe, France and Germany pulled in over $1 billion each, though that was down from the peak year before. This map shows where traditional banks are likely feeling the heat the most from these new challengers.
Okay, so we know where the activity is. What's the actual impact on traditional bank profitability, on their ROA? Does more fintech automatically mean lower profits for the incumbent?
The basic hypothesis is yes. Fintechs often attack the most profitable bits, payments, loans, FX chipping away at margins, forcing incumbents to invest heavily in tech just to keep up.
And does the evidence back that up?
Some studies, yeah. Research looking at China, work by the IMF, they do find a negative link. Fintech growth seems to reduce incumbent banks' interest income and increase their operating costs as they scramble to compete digitally. It can be an expensive race.
So it sounds pretty negative for the old guard, but you said nuance.
Right, always nuance. The IMF paper, for example, found the impact isn't uniform. Smaller banks, like cooperatives, might struggle more because they lack the resources to invest, but larger commercial banks, they might actually benefit.
Benefit? How?
Through partnerships. They can team up with fintechs, offer new services, maybe gain non-interest income. Also, the competitive pressure from fintech can be a catalyst, forcing incumbents to get leaner, improve their own digital offerings, become more efficient overall. That can actually boost profitability long-term if they adapt well.
So it's not just a threat, it's a catalyst for change.
Exactly. So a better way to think about it might be, fintech increases the variance in ROA within a market. It sorts the banks out. The agile, adaptive ones might thrive, finding new ways to compete or collaborate. The slow, inefficient ones get left behind, their traditional profits eroded.
So it widens the gap between the best and the worst performers, creates winners and losers among the incumbents.
Precisely. The average ROA might dip initially, but the performance spread gets much wider.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about the fintechs themselves, especially the neobanks, the digital-only challengers? Everyone loves an underdog story. Are they actually winning the profit game?
The profitability paradox of neobanks. They definitely have advantages. Their operating costs are way lower, 60, 70% less per customer, mainly because no branches, no legacy systems.
And they use that cost advantage to offer low fees, slick apps.
Exactly. Great user experience. Very effective at acquiring customers, especially younger ones who live on their phones.
Sounds like a recipe for success. So what's the paradox? Why aren't they dominating the profit league tables?
Because attracting customers is one thing. Making sustainable profit from them is another much harder thing in banking. That's the paradox.
Why is it so hard for them?
Most rely on really thin revenue streams like interchange fees when you use their debit card. That's not much per customer. Crucially, they often lack two things incumbents have. Huge pools of stable, low-cost deposits, and the full range of regulatory licenses needed to do more profitable lending at scale. Lending is still the core profit engine for most banks.
So great at getting users, not so great yet at turning users into deep, profitable relationships.
Largely, yes. They haven't fundamentally cracked the code on profitability for the most part. Meanwhile, the traditional banking sector globally, dominated by incumbents, actually saw its return on equity hit a post-financial crisis high around 12% in 2023. The old guard is proving surprisingly resilient on the profit front.
So the incumbents aren't dead yet. What are they doing to respond to this digital challenge? Are they just sitting back?
Oh, absolutely not. The smart ones are responding aggressively and in multiple ways.
Like what? Just building better apps?
That's part of it. Huge investments in internal digital transformation, improving their own online and mobile experiences to match the neobanks. But it's deeper than that. They're also focused on cost reduction streamlining operations, closing less used branches to improve that cost-to-income ratio we talked about. Getting leaner.
And are they working with fintechs too?
Yes, that's the third big strategy, partnerships and acquisitions. If you can't beat them, or if they have a specific capability you need quickly, you collaborate or buy them. Integrate their tech into your platform.
So combining the new tech with their existing strengths.
Exactly. The thinking is the long-term winners will be those institutions that can successfully blend a modern, easy-to-use digital front end with the scale, the trust, the customer base, and crucially, the profitable balance sheet of a traditional bank. It's about creating a hybrid model, the best of both worlds.
Okay, this incredible mix of forces, profit dynamics, market structure, regulation, innovation, it all comes together. How can we synthesize this? You mentioned a framework, a map.
Yes, we can use a simple 2x2 matrix to help classify these diverse global banking markets. It gives a clear visual way to understand their strategic position.
Okay, a 2x2. What are the axes?
On the vertical y-axis, we put average return on assets, basically, high or low fundamental profitability. On the horizontal x-axis, we put ROA volatility, high or low risk, and predictability. Remember, low volatility means high stability, a high z-score.
Got it. Profitability versus stability. So let's walk through the four quadrants. What's the top right? High ROA, low variance, the sweet spot.
Exactly. These are the stable oligopolies, highly attractive markets. They offer good, predictable returns. Characteristics usually include high concentration, rational competition, strong and stable regulation, and high barriers to entry.
Where do we find these?
Think Canada, Australia, Singapore, the UAE. They tend to have high concentration ratios, high regulatory quality scores, consistently decent ROA, and solid capital levels. It's a stable, profitable environment for the banks already there. The gold standard, really.
Okay. Top right is stable oligopolies. What about bottom right? High ROA, but also high variance.
These are the competitive disparities, high growth markets, lots of potential, often exciting headline growth, and ROA numbers. But that comes with significant risk and unpredictability.
Where does the risk come from?
Macroeconomic swings, political uncertainty, maybe an uneven playing field with state banks versus private banks versus fintechs all competing differently. Regulation might still be evolving.
Examples.
India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, Mexico often fit here. You see those high ROA numbers. Indian private banks at 1.87%. Indonesia over 3% recently. But you might also see higher NPLs sometimes, sensitivity to commodity prices, the influence of state banks, rapid fintech disruption adding to the volatility. High potential, but a bumpier ride.
Makes sense. Now, top left, low ROA, low variance.
These are the commoditized, hyper-competitive markets. Mature, highly developed, very stable, but intense competition means profits are low, even if they're predictable.
Why so low?
Banking services might be seen as a commodity. Margins get squeezed by low interest rates historically, super efficient players, or maybe those nonprofit-focused players like in Germany system.
So Germany fits here. Who else?
Germany, definitely. Japan, with its history of zero rates. France, too, a very mature, competitive market. The economies are strong. Regulation is robust. So they're stable. But making good money is a tough grind for banks there.
Safe, but hard work for low returns.
Okay. Last quadrant, bottom left. Low ROA, high variance.
These are the fragmented and inefficient markets. Generally, the least attractive quadrant. They suffer from structural problems leading to both poor and unpredictable returns.
What kind of problems?
Could be political interference, legacy bad debt issues that never got cleaned up, lots of small inefficient banks, maybe severe external shocks like sanctions or crises.
Any examples?
Russia, unfortunately, fits here now. Hit hard by sanctions, state-dominated, huge uncertainty, high risk, constrained, and volatile profits. High NPLs reflect the underlying stress. It's the quadrant you generally want to avoid if you can. Okay, this 2x2 map, stable oligopolies, high growth, high variance, commoditized, and fragmented and efficient, that's a really clear way to think about the different types of banking markets globally. So for you listening, maybe running a business, investing, or just trying to understand global finance, this isn't just academic. This is a strategic compass. It means ditching the simplistic focus on just headline ROA and using more sophisticated lens. How do you actually use this map for real-world decisions?
It provides critical strategic direction. Decisions about where to invest, where to expand, they have to move beyond that simple ROA number. You need a multi-factor assessment of the risk-adjusted return potential.
So you propose a kind of weighted scorecard.
Exactly. Instead of just ROA, we build a score based on three pillars weighted by importance.
What's the first pillar?
Profitability and efficiency. We give this about 35% weight. Look at the 5-year average ROA for consistency and the market's cost to income ratio, basically. Can you make money efficiently here over time?
Okay, 35% for profit and efficiency. What's next?
Risk and stability. This gets the biggest weight, 45%. Banking is about managing risk. Here we include the Bank Z score for stability, NPL ratios for asset quality, and the regulatory quality index for predictability. The key question, how safe and predictable is this market?
Makes sense to weight risk highest. And the third pillar.
Growth and opportunity with 20% weight. This includes average real GDP growth, the market's potential size increase, and also a qualitative score for the fintech environment. Is it a threat or an opportunity for partnership and innovation? Question, is there a path for future growth?
So combining those three weighted pillars gives you an overall attractiveness score.
Right. It produces an overall attractiveness rank that prioritizes stable, well-regulated markets offering solid risk-adjusted returns with decent growth prospects. It's a much smarter way to evaluate markets than just chasing the highest ROA number.
That's a powerful framework. So how does this translate into actual strategies? How would a global bank approach entering these different types of markets? Let's start with the stable oligopolies like Canada or Singapore.
Entering those is tough. High barriers, dominant incumbents. Starting from scratch, a greenfield entry is probably too slow and expensive.
So what's the play?
Two main options. Acquisition. Buy a smaller existing bank or maybe a specialized non-bank financial firm to get a foothold, a customer base, and that all-important license. Or niche focus. Don't try to compete head-on in mass market retail. Focus on areas where global expertise really counts, cross-border wealth management, trade finance for multinationals, specialized investment banking. Play to your unique strengths.
Okay. Acquisition or niche play for the stable ones. What about the high-growth, high-variance markets like India or Brazil? High potential, but risky.
Here, the strategy needs to embrace the growth but manage the risk. Partnership with a local fintech can be ideal. They bring agility, local knowledge, customer acquisition skill. You bring scale, capital, regulatory expertise.
Makes sense. Any other approach?
A digital first entry. Launch a lean, digital-only brand designed for that market, focusing on mobile access, speed, convenience. Capture the growing digitally savvy population. But, and this is crucial, you need incredibly robust risk management systems tailored to the specific local political, regulatory, and credit risks. Understand the bumps in the road before you hit them.
Got it. Partnership or digital first with heavy emphasis on risk management. Now, the commoditized markets like Germany or Japan, low profit, stable, what do you do there?
Broad-based retail or commercial banking entry, probably not advisable. Margins are just too thin, competition too intense.
So avoid the main battlefield.
Generally, yes. Opportunities are likely limited to highly specialized services where global scale or unique expertise gives you an edge. Think sophisticated capital markets work, asset management for big institutions, helping domestic companies with their international operations. Find specific profitable niches that local players can't serve as well.
So hyper-specialization is key there. And once you're in a market, how you compete also needs to match the market type, right?
Absolutely. Your competitive positioning has to be tailored. In a stable oligopoly, don't start a price war. Compete on brand, trust, service quality, superior technology. Justify a premium price through a better, more reliable experience.
Be the luxury brand of banking.
Something like that. In a high-growth emerging market, it's about speed and access. Simple products, fast digital onboarding, great mobile experience. Grab market share quickly while the pie is growing.
Be fast and easy.
Right. And in a commoditized market, you likely need a dual approach. Either you become the absolute cost leader through ruthless efficiency and automation, or you double down on niche differentiation, becoming the undisputed best in a very specific profitable segment. Either be the cheapest or the best at something very specific.
Makes sense. And underlying all of this is rigorous risk assessment before you commit capital anywhere.
Absolutely essential. You need to look beyond the obvious. Market structure risk. Don't just look at HHI, who are the top players? Private, state, cooperative, what are their real goals? How will that affect you? Regulatory risk. Not just how strict the rules are at CAR, but how good and predictable is the regulation and supervision? Is there risk of sudden policy shifts?
Right, predictability is key.
Macroeconomic risk. How sensitive is this banking system to economic shocks? How resilient is it? And disruption risk. What's the local fintech scene like? Threat or opportunity? Are incumbents adapting well? You need answers to all these before you jump in.
This gives such a clear picture. the landscape, the tools for analysis, the strategic plays. It really leads to a final thought about where banking is headed overall.
It really does. All these trends we've discussed, the complex link between concentration and profit, the vital role of quality regulation, the disruptive and catalytic force of fintech, they all point towards a specific kind of bank succeeding in the future.
Now, it's not the old model.
No, the era of the monolithic, one-size-fits-all global bank trying to do everything everywhere, that's definitively over.
So what does the bank of 2030 look like?
It's a chameleon, highly adaptive. It can run different strategic playbooks in different types of markets simultaneously. It's deeply technology-driven, not just the customer app, but all the way through its operations, risk, compliance, everything, using data, AI, automation for efficiency and foresight. And above all, it's a master of capital allocation. It chooses where to compete based on that sophisticated, data-driven understanding of where sustainable, risk-adjusted returns can actually be generated, not just chasing headlines or simplistic growth stories.
We've covered a huge amount today. Journeyed through this complex, diverging world of global banking, we've debunked some myths, highlighted the hidden power of regulation, grasped the dual nature of fintech disruption. We've really seen how headline numbers can fool you, and true understanding needs that deeper dive into context, into dynamics. And the conclusion seems clear. The one-size-fits-all global bank is history. The future belongs to this adaptable, tech-savvy, strategically astute chameleon, this master of capital allocation. It leaves a final question for you, the listener, to ponder. In this evolving landscape, what kind of financial chameleon do you think will emerge as the ultimate winner? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We really hope this exploration has given you a richer, more nuanced understanding of the powerful forces shaping our global financial system.